old friend, but I got a dear old friend on here tonight, Samuel Sammy Nunley. Sammy is what I say to your brother Jamie.
That's right.
And are you still living in Georgia?
No, I'm in Florida now. I'm in North Florida.
Lots of changes, huh?
Yeah, a lot of change.
Well, I just, the way I got you on this show is, I guess it was a few weeks ago or a couple months ago. You know how you're looking at Instagram, you can tell who's looking at your story. Mm-hmm. And I know the Nunleys. And I saw your name, Samuel Nunley, and the first thing I thought was, oh no, I'm getting trolled here.
What's Sam doing?
Yeah. And so go ahead. You're the newest Catholic I've ever talked to. You're about 24 hours old, right?
Yeah. Last night, 6 p.m. So a little over 24 hours.
You're a newborn Catholic.
Brand new. Last night.
With all the swollen face from birth.
And the cone head.
Yeah, the cone head, the little toboggan, and the little blue outfit, the little towel they snuggle you in. So I've been itching to hear you for weeks. So I'm just going to ask you just to start where you want to. And I'll try to stay out of the way. But thank you, J.R. Files. He's our moderator. Him and Eric the Redneck in Kansas will be moderating for us, kind of troll patrol. So, Sammy, just go ahead and start where you want to and tell us how you became the world's youngest Catholic.
The world's youngest, oldest Catholic, as you can tell by the hair. I am extremely, just really happy to be on here and happy to be able to share that, to be able to share so quickly after confirmation last night is just really cool. And I got confirmed last night. My wife and my children were there at the church that I've been going to for several years. And it's good to be home. It's just like they say, welcome home. It was real. It felt good. There was a spiritual element, a weight to it that was just so good. And I knew being confirmed, I knew it was the right thing. I knew before, but then you're not sure, you know, you have some doubts. But then, I mean, when the oil came out, you know, hands were laid on and it was just like, yes, this is right. This is what I've always wanted. And, I'm so happy to be part of the Catholic faith for sure.
Well, I'm glad to have you in the family, on the team, or 100%. I mean, it's a miracle because the people watching don't know, but I've known your family, I think, since the 1990s.
Yeah, late 90s.
Yeah, and we've been involved in ministry before, but it weren't Catholic.
No, I was a pastor at the time. First time I think I met you. I was a pastor at a Protestant church at the time. And was doing mostly executive pastor work, kind of coming up in that role, and answered that call when I was like 13 years old, and that's where I met you and Connie for the first time, and thought y'all were hilarious and awesome, and really and have loved being able to see Brian, what he's doing, and the whole reason I found your account. Was I was simply out there. It's been a long journey for me, and I want to share that with you. But really just over the last year, just really, really hunkering down, studying all along, but just really diving in and looking for some type of online support to try to kind of figure out how people feel about these things. Because you can read stuff in books, and I read a lot, but you know, you want to kind of feel where people are culturally and how they sit with their faith. And I came across Catholic for Rednecks. Did not recognize your name. Didn't recognize you at all. And had no idea it was you until down the road. I was like, oh wow, this is John. And then I was like, hey buddy, remember me? You won't believe this.
I'm still pinching myself.
Yeah. Yeah, totally crazy. And I didn't know that I know you know enough about your journey, know that you had kind of left the kind of the Pentecostalish, Baptisty type thing that we were doing. And I know that you had gone Presbyterian for a while, but I didn't know anything beyond that.
Yeah. And
so it was a shock to me too. I was like, oh my gosh, this is why, you know, very cool.
Yeah. I've all bumped into Jamie here and there the last 20 years. I don't know how we just bump into each other sometimes. One of it was when I was breaking out of the Word of Faith, Prosperity Gospel. I guess that was a rough exit for me and hurt feelings and all. But, you know, I always told Jamie the way I thought about your mom and dad and family, the utmost respect. And, you know, that nothing I say about the Word of Faith, Prosperity Gospel had anything to do with any of y'all.
Right.
But when I got out, I busted out the wall, you know.
You did the Kool-Aid Man.
Yeah, I waste any time getting out and telling what I thought about it. But then, you know, just by the very few words we've shared recently, you went through a lot more doors before you came to the Catholic one.
Yeah, I did. You want me to start back kind of at the beginning there with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so I would say, so I was, just so you know, I was in ministry, Protestant ministry, for about 2 decades. And part of that, there was some organizational consulting for nonprofits. I did kind of half businessy, and you were around me. You kind of knew, I mean, me in that role. It was like half business guy, half pastor kind of thing. Jumped out of that, and then was a banker for about 10 years after that. Just jumped out of that to find my way back into doing good stuff. I'm an executive director for a small family nonprofit that's getting going. So back on the side of doing good overall. But there's good to do in banking too. I did some good there, I hope. But overall, my first inklings toward the Catholic faith, John, they were back when I was 20 years old. Before we met, before I was in ministry, I remember this is part of, I've been thinking about this all along and trying to digest all of this, but the first time I was in undergrad, I was a freshman in college, on the fourth floor dorm, and, was flipping through my Bible, trying to understand some things, you know, kind of when you're young in the faith, or even kind of this Protestant freewheeling, I'm going to look in the Bible and see what it tells me. You know, that kind of an idea. So I was kind of doing that, and I was flipping through Daniel. I was flipping through Revelation. I was tying that back to the Last Supper, things like that. And I really got this impression that the establishment of the church in the world today was definitely in the crucifixion and the resurrection, but more importantly, it was in communion. It was in the Eucharist. And I didn't have any basis for that, because of the theology that I was given. So I came home, you know, started sharing, hey, look at what I've learned, blah, blah, blah. You know, where did this happen? Where do you think the kingdom of God, the inception of the kingdom of God? And everybody's like, oh, yeah, you know, at the resurrection or at the cross. And I was like, no, man, it's a communion. It's a communion. And, you know, and everybody just looked at me like I had three heads. And I really didn't know what I was saying. But I knew that there was kind of a deeper understanding of what might have been going on. There was kind of a revelation to something that I eventually found to be true, but really didn't really understand at the moment. But God was still already then kind of drawing me to something deeper. And so in the middle of that, I went into ministry, and all along, same thing, big history buff, always read a lot. Read a lot of theology books, family nerd by far, right? I mean, that was me. And was happy to pull out the Anchor Bible Dictionary when everybody wanted an answer about something, you know, that kind of a thing. Really, really enjoyed that. But the problem was, like you've said, anytime you begin to read history and you begin to read early church fathers, you begin to read these things, it should come with a warning label, because it did not take long for me to figure out, and I was in my 20s at this point, late 20s, early 30s, that that the early church fathers were Catholic, that there was there was a lot more to that ancient belief, and the idea of a separation didn't occur. It just wasn't there. It's still not there. People can tell you that it's there. It's just not there. Now, and again, as I've continued to study, I've learned more about why that. But I figured that out earlier than I should as a Protestant minister. And then that's when the problem started. You know, I don't know if you ever, did you ever had a moment like that when you were kind of just reading through and you're like,
yeah. You know, I worked with your parents.
Yeah.
And one of my secret dreams or desires was to work with your parents.
Oh, really?
I remember your dad saying that he needed to hire somebody whose last name wasn't Nunley. You know, I mean, I know I was hardcore redneck because your dad used to jab at me here and there. But yeah, I remember doing a restudy on the prosperity message and healing. Mm-hmm. And when I say healing, I don't mean trauma. I'm talking about, you know, the divine healing, you know, you got cancer or arthritis, you know, healing and prosperity. And what I wanted to do was find out what the early church fathers' teaching was concerning divine prosperity.
Don't do it.
Man, you talk about something blowing up in my face.
Yeah.
I remember sitting at the dining room table when I had a dictionary early church fathers' writings. Mm-hmm. It was called 700 quotes or 7,000 quotes. And I looked up prosperity and it was polar opposite of what I had been teaching for years.
Yeah.
It was not the prosperity message that I had learned by any stretch of imagination. And then I got to the healing part. There was a few miracles there, but it was like the early church fathers were embracing sickness as a way of suffering to glorify God. It made my stomach hurt and my brain hurt. And I closed that book up real quick. But like you said, just now, what are we going to do with it?
Yeah, it's there. And that's the difficult thing. It's like, and everybody's like, all right, well then go back to your Bible. And you know, if it's not in the Bible, it's not there. It's like, but everything around the Bible, the tradition, you know, now that we know that's part of that whole process is there. And once you begin to figure that out, there was another moment I was doing seminary work and was writing a large paper on the gifts of the Spirit and trying to figure out, really trying to prove that they had always existed, were part of the system and should be, and they are, which is great. Cause you know, who believes that? Catholics do. They believe that. Again, just bumped into that. I read a book by George Montague and Killian O'Donnell called Christian Initiation and the Baptism of the Holy Spirit. And they talk about that with the Bible, with the early church fathers' writings, and how that was always a part of things. And I was like, great, I've got primary source proof text for what I believe. But it was a Catholic book. same thing. And I was like, well, why are we doing something different when they were doing it before?
Mm-hmm. And
again, the decades of dealing with that and knowing it, but also not feeling comfortable knowing it. I wouldn't say it became a problem. It just became, the more I understood and the more I learned, it became clear that there was no apostasy of Catholics, which is before the original church and the early church, and then it was recreated through Luther, and all of that is mental scaffolding that was not reflected in. It's not reflected in what happened in church history. And I just, it, you know, like I said, it's all those books should come with warning labels. It just messed me up. And so I've had that and dealt with that for years. So what I did is what a lot of Protestants do which is I went from a very kind of tight core of kind of a Baptist theology that I was given as a kid. I had supplanted like a Pentecostal belief, which then I had trouble with that because they don't agree on things. And so I was like, okay, I got to get out of this. So I went Wesleyan. I went Methodist. I went that direction. Okay, there's room inside of that. There's also responsibility inside of accountability inside of that. So I went Methodist, and I actually pastored a Methodist church for about 4.5 years.
Wow.
And there were parts of it I loved. I loved the doing word service of word and table too, you know, cranking that joker out and doing again communion. But the closest thing I could feel to the power of communion that I knew ultimately is in the Eucharist in John 6, and loved the liturgy, loved the history, loved the willingness for responsible grace, which is more of a Catholic idea that he brought back post-Reformation. You know, no, you got to do right. You got to be responsible with the grace God's given you. Yes, your life has to reflect. You can't just do whatever you want, you know. And so I stayed there for a long time. And then I moved on from there to open theology, to process theology, to narrative post-liberal theology. And I mean, everybody's like, well, who cares? And you're right. I mean, that was me trying to compensate for the reality that I knew, which was the Catholic faith has all the pieces in the puzzle. It fits together. And there's no way to do that. There's no way to work your way through that. And there's just no way. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with this? And so I landed on more of an Eastern Orthodox approach because I saw in John Wesley's studies that he was attracted to Eastern Orthodox. I was like, okay, maybe that's my last stop. So got into that, read the Philokalia, read the early, you know, and I had come across some of those too in my studies about the charismata, the gifts of the Spirit, all this other stuff. Like I'd read Simeon the New Theologian. I'd read some of these things. But also knew it extended beyond that because there were mystics all the way in the 1200, 1300, 1400s in the Catholic faith. It was still there, you know? And so I thought, okay, well, I can be here. And what I was, by that time, I was going to a non-denominational kind of hip church where they would do the Stations of the Cross or occasional responsive reading, but they also, you know, would pull out, you know, some AC/DC song to do the opening of, it's a cool church.
Church one I had a little bit.
Yeah, probably so. And but in the end, what I had was I was going to church in a Protestant capacity, but I was theologically in the Eastern Orthodox camp, and I was okay with that. And everybody thought that was cool. You know, oh, cool, man. Yeah, you must really love contemplative prayer. You know, all this kind of stuff. Well, what are you? Well, I'm a Christian mystic. Well, what does that mean? You know. So I sat there for maybe 7 years, eight years. And in the middle of that was trying to plant a church separately that kind of incorporated those elements. Again, right, if you don't agree with something, you go start something new. And you know, I was in the middle of that too. Mm-hmm. And then along the way, I probably should stop and come up for air. Do you question or anything? Are you good? You want me to keep going?
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
You said something that jarred memory. And I've been trying to think where I got it. What was your mom and dad's feeling of communion?
Well,
was it different than a Protestant view?
Mom, no. They always believed it was spiritual or symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
But in the kind of that charismatic tradition, there was plenty of room for not Eucharistic miracles, as we know. Once again, everything was already, everybody's already done it. I mean, the Catholics already did everything, mm-hmm. you know. And so, but the idea of allowing communion to be a contact point of grace for supernatural events, sure, they believed that. But that was a pretty common Pentecostal charismatic kind of belief, you know, where there's, whether it be oil or laying hands on somebody, or maybe communion is the gateway to God doing something unique. They were open to that for sure. But the idea of the Eucharist being the presence of God, not at all. No.
So, it's just, I wanted to blame it on your parents, but I guess I'm wrong. But there was a couple, and I was thinking it was them. Maybe it was, do you know John White up here? Do you remember him?
John who?
White, W-H-I-T-E, fellowship. Just like your parents. I mean, same thing, about the same age and all. And one of those couples had a strong Catholic feeling about communion.
Okay.
I remember taking communion from them. I thought it was your parents, I guess I'm wrong. But they had the bread and they kind of dipped it in the grape juice, of course.
Yeah.
And this is Jesus.
Oh, really?
His body and it's his blood. And this is for you. This is personal. And something come over me. And from that point forward, you know, that's what I believed. I believed, you know, even before I became Catholic, I believed that's exactly what that couple said. This is Jesus. It says it in the Bible all over. Every place it talks about it, it says it's Jesus.
Mm-hmm. It sure does.
And it just made sense to me right there in the communion line, not in the library. It just it was personal. So I guess I got your parents mixed up. I'm getting old, man. I can't remember.
I don't know that they ever did that. I heard some. I remember one time talking about, once again, when you're a Protestant minister, you think you are reading or finding out things about the Bible that is somehow revelatory, that you just haven't read the other people that did it, you know, 2000 years before you, right? But I remember doing a sermon on the understanding of the term remembrance, the Hebraic understanding of the word remembrance in communion, and that it was more like the idea of not remembering when you went to the beach, but simply imagining your feet in the sand and feeling that. So there was a little bit more gravity to the remembering. But again, that's called imaginative and contemplative prayer. And they were doing that pretty far back. So the Protestant ministers that I was always with, even, you know, in the Wesleyan tradition, believed in the weight of the symbol of communion, but there was no moment, there were no bells, there were no lifting. They weren't sliding their chips all the way in. There may have been a little more weight given to it, as there should have been, but no one ever crossed that line.
Funny, Sam, because I remember, you know, I went to Rhema.
Yeah.
And I took two different classes, the history of the Bible and church history, two different classes. And they were by a guy named Cooper Beatty. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He was a Quaker, as a matter of fact, a Quaker.
Okay. Cool.
And they called him Machine Gun Kelly, because he was so fast in his, I mean, you could not take notes. You'd be taking notes and he would be 30 minutes ahead of you before you got, I mean, he's, but both those classes, something that made an impression on me. Now, I had just left the police department to go up to Rhema in Oklahoma. And I'm used to writing police reports based on facts, who, what, where, why, you know, timelines, chain of evidence,
right?
Was a bit with me, and it dawned on me in those classes how about 80% or more of both classes was 100% Catholic all through that semester to the very tail end, because there wasn't a whole lot to talk about between the so-called Reformation and when our time hit, you know, the
right,
the healing, the
Azusa Street, kind of 20th century.
Yeah, to us, it's kind of like a dead spot from the Reformation till the Hagans and Oral Roberts showed up with signs and wonders and miracles. You know, there was an explosion. But everything before that. I remember that he used to talk about some priest that had a ministry of signs, wonders, and miracles. And he said there were people that would line up for days to this cathedral. And I don't know if he's talking about Padre Pio now. I don't know. But there's flickerings of that, Sam.
Yeah.
In Word of Faith.
Absolutely.
And it dawned on me later that all that miraculous stuff they were seeking so hard for had existed for thousands years in the Catholic Church.
Well, that's what really opened my eyes. I did some schooling where I took all the thematic, I called it experiential Christianity, the physicality, the esoteric side, but the visceral side, where you could feel it, you know, in your gut that God was around, right? That idea, and begin to go back through history all the way through. And yeah, you could talk about the burned over district in New England. You can talk about, the movement of relics and things that surrounded that in the Catholic Church. You take it all the way back. You talk about my saint. You talk about Bernard of Clairvaux. You talk about in France. You talk about everybody all the way back. And there's never a point where something supernatural was not occurring all the way through. Now, in the middle of that, the church that has done that and never shied away from it and never stopped believing in that, it's the Catholic Church. In fact, one of the things that Martin Luther was very concerned about doing is because he wanted to tie the power back to the scriptures so that it could be interpreted as the sole authority away from the Pope. But the other thing that he was worried about was people getting the idea that they could go to see the knuckle bone of Saint so-and-so, touch it, and get healing for their daughter. And so he went out of his way to talk about Popish superstition, Catholic superstition. And he really cut off the supernatural elements of the Reformed and the Protestant tradition at the knees. And so the Catholics were like, well, that's fine. It's not a great decision, but you know, we're going to keep doing what we're doing. And that's what they do. And they've continued to embrace the supernatural. The Protestant tradition just hasn't as much. And so when the 20th century showed up, Azusa Street, the Pentecostal movement, which is 500-600 million people strong, now it's the biggest Protestant movement because it incorporates all the supernatural elements that belonged in the Catholic Church that were then removed. And that's one of the worst things that happened, in my opinion, with the Protestant tradition, is kind of the cutting off of the knees of people who just simply wanted to touch God. Right. And so what happens, then you've got theosophy, then you've got spiritism, you've got all these occult movements, esoteric movements that bubble up, mesmerism, Anton Mesmer, right? Or Swedish Borgianism. Right? You've got all kinds of stuff that are happening all over the Western world, which are trying to substitute for what God already gave everybody in the Catholic Church. Yeah. And in the middle of that, it's one of the saddest periods of church history. But even today, if you get the most commonplace, if Wiccans, pagans, come back to the church, they most often don't go to the Protestant church. They go to the Catholic Church. Because
more goth.
Or what?
It's more goth. It's cooler.
That's right. There's ritual.
Yeah.
And there's a belief in the supernatural, and there's the identity of this mysterious God that they can approach. And
you're right about it. I've never heard anyone say it like you're saying it. I know a lady that's into Wicca big time, and I've told her family before, if she ever finds her way to a traditional Latin mass,
yes,
Catholic Church, she's gonna be so blown away. Yeah.
So that my journey led me to where basically I tipped over into Catholicism because, you know, that's like everybody, you read too much. I mean, was it John Henry Carl Newman said that to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. And it's true. I mean, I wish And I tell people this, I don't want to say that I'm embarrassed that it took so long for me to figure it out, but it took a long time for me to figure it out. And again, I knew, I'm 48 now, so I knew 28 years ago that something was up. Mm-hmm. I did. And I was stubborn. I wasn't willing to move beyond that. And so I had been to plenty of Eastern Orthodox churches. I'd been to Catholic Mass before, as part of kind of my whole religious background and exploration. But I didn't consistently start going to Catholic Mass until I started dating my wife, Amber. And she never pressured me. We would go to Mass one Sunday and go to my cool church the other Sunday. And just kind of did that, bouncing back and forth. And she was very kind. Very kind to do that.
What odds? She's Catholic.
She's Catholic. Now, she was raised in a, I don't know how much of her life she wants me to put on here, but I'll say that she was raised in a sect or a group of Protestantism that is much maligned. And she was like, I'm leaving all this. This is crazy town. And I'm going to find the deepest roots of traditional faith that I can find in the Christian faith. And she went Catholic. That's how she landed there. You know,
I remember having conversations with Christian friends saying, I wish we could just go back to the early church, you know, and be like the early, little do we know what we were wishing for.
Yeah.
You know? But let me ask you this, and you don't have to share anything that you don't want to.
Sure.
Have any of these conversations with your parents?
Yeah. Yeah, I've had conversations with, so for anybody that's watching, my parents have been, I grew up in a great family, a very good family, and I'm super thankful for that. Both of my parents were strong Christians. We were taught the version of Protestantism we were given early, taught it strong. And even then, I mean, I joke with them now. I'm like, you guys are a little more Catholic than you want, because Dad was... I mean, Dad, Mom would teach us the Book of Revelation, and they would approach it from more of a presentism, a preterist approach, which is much more Catholic than kind of a futurist Tim LaHaye, you know, Left Behind series approach. So they weren't having any of that, even when we were growing up. Mm-hmm. And so my brother and I grew up in that environment. So when I told them, they were gracious. They said what I would expect a Protestant to say, which is, as long as you believe in Jesus, you know, then we're fine. Which is tying that back to some, you know, connection between works and faith, which, you know, is in their mind somehow Catholics are working for their salvation, which anybody that kind of reads knows that's not what's going on. And I said, of course, all Catholics do, and I'm looking forward to this. And then my brother, who's a pastor, was great. He's like, yeah, you always been like half Catholic anyway. So they've been great. They've been supportive, and have always been supportive of Amber's faith as well as a Catholic. So, yeah. So I'm thankful for that. I mean, I've gotten some Protestant hate otherwise, but not from my family. I'm blessed.
You'll get a lot of that. You'll see. Let me ask you this. What did you have any particular struggles with anything within Catholic teaching or culture?
No, not really. I read enough. I valued history and tradition as the understanding of how to help interpret the Bible. And I'd done a lot of studies about Jewish roots, Hebraism's understanding what Jesus was saying or alluding to, that maybe from the Mishnah or, you know, some Jewish text. So I was familiar with a secondary text interpreting words that then Jesus would use, because I'd read a lot of that. I'd studied a lot of that. So I didn't have any problem with the whole, hey, you're, you know, it's not in the Bible, therefore it's not there. And any Protestants that are out there, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense.
My understanding, which I now know is wrong, and probably the bulk of Protestants, is they believe that the Jews only went by this Old Testament that we have. Through Malachi. That's our whole Bible. They don't realize they had all kinds of other stuff.
All kinds of other stuff. And, I mean, it takes, I mean, if you tell a Protestant that, Rachel was venerated similar to the way Mary was in traditional Jewish sources, you don't hear about that. And so what you have is then, well, why did the Catholic Church pick up this Mary veneration, this worship thing? It's like, dude, it's Jewish. It's Jewish. They import the temple, the Passover lamb, what you experience in Mass, the clothes, it's Jewish, it's Jewish, it's Jewish, it's Jewish. And because there was an anti-Semitic part of Protestantism that Luther used to separate, we lost some of the keys to the basic things of what make a good church service in the early church. And so part of that was kind of reclaiming that. But I didn't have any problems with anything. I could tell you some real story where I really struggled with something, but really was more like, you know, the Jewish history that I understood, the interpretive dialogue that I understood, plus the scriptures and the ability to kind of put all that together. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Well, you know, I remember going through this journey, and I'm still on it, all Catholics are. But I remember, I don't even know if I had confirmed or not yet, but thinking about, you know, when you read the Old Testament and good Protestants, we read the whole Bible every year, and about how this sacrifice would endure forever. Forever, forever. And I kept thinking, but it didn't, you know, until I became Catholic. And I see how the sacrifice is still, you know, it's that one sacrifice. Like the one in Leviticus and Deuteronomy was pointing towards Jesus. And then the one we do at Mass, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it never did click in my mind how it could be an enduring forever for all generations.
Right.
But I never heard that part about Rachel.
Yeah. I actually picked that up from Brant Petrie, which I love his books. He wrote one on Mary, wrote one on the Eucharist. He does a great job of pulling in all the Jewish understanding. Scott Hahn's done some of that as well, but I just like Brant Petrie's books better. And a lot of that is available. I got my feet wet and all that in Protestant academic circles, in Protestant, but they just don't quite make the jump, you know, almost like the idea of the swaddling cloth. I mean, you've probably heard that, where swaddling cloth was what they put they did that as part of the sacrifice of the Passover lambs. It's not some random cloth. It's a typological cloth that was used to denote the significance of Jesus dying as the Passover lamb. And all that stuff makes sense when you have someone kind of, you know, just kind of walk you through it, and you're like, oh. So honestly, I mean, John, I was sheepish that I didn't get it earlier.
Yeah.
I was embarrassed.
You are, I'm not trying to say you overthink, but you're a thinker.
I am.
You are an intellectual, and it's got to check the boxes. You, no matter what's going on here, you've got to filter here.
Right.
You're an intelligent guy, and you're not going to get hoodwinked.
Yeah.
I'm telling Connie, I read the entire catechism before the first day of RCIA.
Did you?
I told my wife, I said, I'm going to read this thing right now. Because if there's any, I'm not going down another road of deception and blah, blah, blah. I said,
yeah.
I want to start those classes if this bothers me. So let me ask you this. Last night was your confirmation.
Yeah.
And usually, and this is a question I ask on Instagram, I've noticed there's like been three waves of the last 3 weeks, all these churches having confirmation. I'm saying early.
Yeah.
I was always taught it was Easter Vigil, Saturday night. Right. And that sin just, you know, droves come in. I don't want to say trickle in because it's not a trickle. It's an avalanche.
Yeah.
Is there a reason behind that?
Yeah, I'll say that. And then before you say that, I was talking with the deacon that taught our ICA class, RCIA class the other day, and there's just this waves of people coming back to the Catholic Church, particularly Protestants. And a lot of Protestant ministers, he was telling stories about Protestant ministers that are experiencing revelations of saints and Mary and some other things, where there's just a move back to this. And it's kind of a national or global phenomenon where people are just like, okay, this church feels weird. Everything else is too loose. There's nothing solid anymore. The Catholic Church is solid and has never stopped being solid. It's never changed and it hasn't. And I agree with you on that. There's just a ton of people. As far as the reason I was a candidate, so I've been baptized as a kid in the Trinitarian formula, so that counted. My wife had not, so she got confirmed and baptized on Easter at Easter Vigil. So what they're doing is with the candidates, because probably there's a lot of people coming in, they're getting all of us in early so that we can partake of Holy Week activities and enjoy them for what they are. Now, there are a couple other people that, if they need to be specifically confirmed by the bishop, they may have to wait to get to the bishop for that. But yeah, there seems to be like they're bringing the candidates in early, but they're bringing the elect, the new elect in as part of Easter.
Yeah, I kind of like that, because just to be honest with you, I remember my first communion. I felt like, this is going to sound bad and dirty and vulgar. Do you remember how when the king and queen would get married,
mm-hmm.
and the maids in waiting and the men would stay right outside the door to listen?
Right, to make sure that, yeah.
For the consummation of the marriage?
Yeah.
You know, they were like, he's in there, you know.
We're good.
Yeah, that's the way I felt a little bit when my first Eucharist, all these, because I go to, you know, the church I was confirmed at is a mega church. It's probably one of the biggest Catholic churches. I know it is in Birmingham.
Okay.
You know, it's jam-packed, over 1,000 every Mass.
Wow. And,
I felt like I was being gawked at, because at that time they came down the line, they confirmed us, did all the, you know, the neat stuff, and then you come back in the line and you took your first communion, and I'm thinking more of these people were looking to see, watch me take my communion instead of me having communion.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? So I kind of don't even remember it, but the following day at Easter, I went for my first communion with one of the guys, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay, I'm one of the guys, you know. And that's when it hit me, was that, you know, my first communion. Then I only had communion from my priest, I think, for 6 weeks straight. So I went out to California, to San Francisco, and it was the first communion I had apart from my nest, where I had been in RCIA and, mm-hmm. you know, fed like a little birdie. And I'm in line because this church out there in California had an octangular stage and building. You know, it was a UFO church, you know, the Norvus Order Nightmare Church. It was St. Pius in Redwood City, if you want to Google it. But I don't even know what line. I'm trying to get in line with the priest. And somehow, when I got through there, it was like a 6'1" supermodel, blonde female. She is an extraordinary minister. Like, she had a top up to here. All this was bare. She had blonde hair. She's in heels. She had on her blonde hair pushed back by her shades. And I was like, she was like, the body of Christ. And I'm like, no. It just upset me so bad. You know, I was like, give it to me. And I stomped off. And it just wrecked my whole thing because it was so perfect from Easter Vigil that day. But that was my first experience with the EM.
I haven't had that yet. I just went right through, but I agree with you. The oil and the anointing and all that, it felt very special. The first communion, I was nervous. And so I remember taking it and everything, but I was like, okay, good. I'm glad I'm going to get to do this over and over and over again because it's going to become more special. Right. I was more worried about making sure I didn't mess up because we were taking it at first. It was still like, okay, this is good. You know, I'm eating some Jesus right now. That's good. I got it.
I understand perfectly. It's funny because, you know, the doubts you were talking about.
Yeah.
I think it was like a week later that I was sitting there having doubts. I mean, it was like the week after Easter. And I'm thinking, what in the world did I just do? I've been word of faith, Baptist. All that. Here I am. I've become Catholic. I've been thinking this was a cult my whole life. Here I am, Catholic. And I was having a moment there. And a lady had given me a Catholic prayer book as a confirmation gift the week before. So I looked at it, and I had flipped it over on the front where the back was showing next to me. I looked at it. My eyes got about this big around because I was praying, Lord, show me a sign that I have not effed up.
Mm-hmm.
And my eyes got about that big around. I tapped Connie and I said, look. And right there, stamped into the back of my book, was 2333 in gold lettering. That was my police employee number. Number from my police days.
That's cool.
And it was like, there is no way that's a coincidence. No way.
Yeah.
So from that day forward, I never doubted. But did you, you said you had a few doubts?
Well, I didn't have any doubts about the scriptural interpretation. And I think that's part of the reason I was able to, and it's hard to do, but I was able to take the other sources and understand how it all works together. I know from a Protestant background, I was already kind of past that. I'd gotten past that, you know. And I was talking with someone the other day where I was like, hey, you know, well, what about this? You know, in the Bible, it says this and this. And they go by something. I call it the white crow syndrome or black crow syndrome, which is if you could just prove one thing wrong, that makes it all wrong. Mm-hmm. Because they don't value tradition or any exterior sources that would validate the overall narrative of the church. And that's exactly what happened. So when that individual said, yeah, but what about what? I was like, you know, I could go into that, but I'm not going to do that. Because you can't change that mindset. So I'd already moved past that mindset. Now, did I have questions about becoming Catholic after being a minister for 20 years and all that? I was worried. I wasn't worried that much because I'm like, I'm doing this. I don't care, you know. But I was worried that I would get some blowback for it and still expect people to not agree with everything that I have to say. But at the same time, you know, I'm fine with it. Now, yesterday before confirmation, I had a moment of slight panic where I was like, is this right?
Yeah.
But I was also like, now, dude, look, you know this is right. You've known this for years, this is right. And it's okay. But part of the reason I'm excited to come on, you know, things like this is to tell people how I got to the other side of it and be okay with it. And the other thing that really made a difference for me is just the social media community, the internet community. There are a lot of trolls out there, but there's a lot of great people, just like what you're doing, John. And that was extremely, extremely helpful to me.
I just, you know, I started doing this because I thought I was going to have an original idea. I really did. When I first went on YouTube, September of 17, I thought I was a pioneer. I thought I had an idea. I'm going to put Catholic stuff out there where a guy like me can get it. I'm going to get away, get all the misinformation out of the way. Hey, Haley. And, you know, it's funny because if you YouTube kayaking down the Amazon River a few times, after a while you'll find out there's 25,000 people interested in kayaking the Amazon River because you get all these links.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the way it was with Catholic. I found out, man, there's like 100,000 of us on here.
Yeah.
You know, sharing memes and videos. But
yeah,
I'm glad you found it, man, because I pray. I laid here on the bed before we came on. I prayed.
Did you?
Let people see this. Especially Nimnob, that guy that Eric just blocked. You know,
yeah.
I don't know reading what he was saying.
Yeah.
But the dude is talking about the thing about Catholics and perverts.
Mm-hmm.
And me and you know from being in Protestant ministry for years and years, man, we already knew about all that stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's kind of, you can approach it two ways. And I'm kind of like you. I'm trying to decide, you know, where does God want me to go? And what does he want me to do with this? How can I help? And you and I've texted about that a little bit. But one of the things you can respond to a guy like that and say, actually, you have a better chance of your school administrator molesting you 110 times before you ever get to a priest, which that's the numbers.
Yeah.
But does that serve anybody's purpose? What's going on is that person has been personally hurt in some way, or literally does not care. And if it's a person that needs healing, then you have to look past that and help find a way to do that. And so, however I talk to folks, I want to talk to the way that people talk to me when I was a Protestant, which I had a core of maybe 7 or 8 Catholics that I knew that were actually older than me, who were really, really kind and really peaceful. And they just lived a very peaceful life that was very attractive to me as a Protestant, because I was more worried about being right and figuring everything out. And these people were, they knew that they had it right. They're just trying to be holy and peaceful.
Right.
Like, golly, I want some of that. And so that really made a difference for me. And so as I was going through this process, I reached out to every one of them, all the way back to high school camp, Bible camp friends that converted to Catholicism, and said, hey, I'm going through this. You know, it's been a long journey. I just want you to know that your faith made a difference for me. And I remember that 30 years later. And they were like, yeah, man, thank you so much for telling me that. And then several of them have been like, hey, how's your journey? When you get confirmed, I'm sending you a gift. I mean, Catholics are nice, man. Catholics are good people.
It's a different crowd. I have found out. I've always been amazed at how many fanatics there are in Catholic world, because you don't see them in real life, at least not in Birmingham, Alabama.
Right.
So every now and then you might see some weirdo with a Mary bumper sticker or pro-life, 14 kids in a van. You know, I would see something like that. I remember once I saw a priest at the gas station getting gas and all, you know, but, you know, living here where I live is just so, there's not any Catholics.
Yeah. Yeah. You're kind of in the desert until you travel a little north or south, wherever you get up to EWTN area and kind of up in there. But which I want to come visit all that. I think the museum, Eucharistic Miracles Museum's up there, right?
Yeah, it's up France. That's 60 miles north.
Okay. Yeah,
Irondale. I went up there about 10 times before ever winning that thing. I didn't know what was paying attention to it. And one time we said, what's going here? It's hot, you know, to cool off. And that place is mind blowing.
Yeah, I want to go see it.
Yeah. Sure.
But we have, where I am, We're not saying this is as big as Birmingham by any stretch, but there's a good, strong Catholic community here. And you're right. Catholics just live different. They send their kids to a different place. They live life differently. They eat differently. Their schedules are different. And they don't apologize. I mean, it is a full way of life. And that
how do you say the word?
Liturgical?
Yeah, it's a liturgical.
Liturgical life. That's a great way to put it. I've never heard anybody put it that way. You're right.
Yeah, because, you know, like my son, Brian, I mean, he's way more into it than I am. It's funny because I got into it on fire before he did, you know. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, he got thunderstruck, and he does the Ember Days, and he does a lot of stuff that I ain't even Googled yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's way more devout. But I heard people say if you live according to the church calendar, you know, and that's why they originally start RCIA, where you start when you go through the whole year.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I went to RCIA, I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Right.
I couldn't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah. It was, I knew what I was going through, but I loved the fact that it took me a whole friggin' year to, it's like, they really want you to know. And so there's kind of a divide among, from what I can tell, once again, I'm new and learning, but there's a lot of cradle Catholics. There's a lot of people that don't understand the basics of why, like I heard a Catholic the other day tell me that they don't do any scripture in Mass, and that's why they went Protestant. I'm like, dude, the whole Mass is scripture. I mean, what are you talking about? And then there's kind of another crew that's coming on, or that are converts, or that have been devout their whole life, and man, they know what's going on, and they live it down to the core. And you have to kind of find out what type of Catholic you're talking to. See where they're coming from.
I've heard that. I remember I met a lady on here when I first started my channel. She said she grew up Catholic and never heard the gospel. Went to Mass, never heard the gospel. And I'm glad it didn't pop in my mind while I had her on, because I would have said things a lot. I wouldn't have been so nice. But I'm thinking, how can you look at this every Sunday your entire life and not have a freaking clue of why you're there at Mass? Right. I mean, you got a bleeding man nailed on a cross.
Yeah.
With thorns. You got a Eucharist. You got all the stained glass stations painting them. I mean, it was literally designed for a man that could not read or hear to be saved.
Absolutely.
Now, well, you do the reading. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't get it either. And I think I've always been, I love family, and I love how the Catholic Church approaches family and marriage and men and women and life. I love all those things. One of my favorite quotes by Mother Teresa is, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family. And I mean, it's a pretty common one. People know that one. But I feel like when you get in those situations where people are going through the process of just doing Mass, there's an element there. There's a parental catechesis that has to occur at the home. And I experienced that as a Protestant. My parents were like, hey, boys, sit down before, you know, the Sunday night Disney movie comes on. We're going to pop the Bible up and read the Sermon on the Mount and talk about it. I got that. You know what I mean? But I'm people that go through Mass who don't understand Mass, it feels like that there's a disconnect there. There's not.
Well, I worry about my granddaughter, because, you know, she's cradle Catholic, first one ever cradle Catholic.
And, yeah.
You know, but I worry because, you know, what a lot of people are looking for in church is entertainment.
Right.
And just a kid, you know, of course, they would rather go to this church that's got the fog machines and the fancy music and the clowns on the stage and the, you know, the nutcrackers, you know, all the stuff instead of the Mass, you know. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, you know, how do you instill that in a kid? The only way you can do it is at home, like you said.
Right. Yeah, I think that, and I know that when I was a Protestant minister, I felt the pressure. You probably felt this too. I definitely wanted church to be attractional. And then I was like, well, the church needs to be missional. And I was like, great. The Catholics did that around 70 AD. So once again, everything's been done. I never made the connection that my revelation as to how the missional church should work might've been done by someone before me. It's kind of, I was arrogant in that way. I just didn't understand. But I do remember being a Protestant minister and just feeling the crushing weight of the fact that I needed people to find this event important enough to them to keep coming back.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I also was acutely aware that I had, that we had removed the most important part of the service as Protestants in not having the Eucharist. And so I was having to come up with some way, whether it be through quippy sermons or some new revelatory teaching that God had given to me, or some cool music, or just so that somebody could feel subjectively like they had some goosebumps, and then just not sure when the Eucharist is the key. That's the key. That's the reason church exists. And when you remove Christ from the building, then what do you have left? And so I can imagine it would be difficult to me being if I was a younger parent who was Catholic and had children, it would be easier to bridge that with here's what we believe. You don't have to wait for Pastor so-and-so to tell you the new cool thing he thinks that, you know, and how that, you know, connects to this movie clip from 1984, you know?
Right.
And so honestly, there's just a lot of wrestling with that I've just been able to go, you know, I don't have to worry about that.
Do you remember when the phrase Elvis has left the house?
Absolutely.
But the people are still there. But the king's, you know, in his limousine, 8 blocks out.
Yeah.
Man, they don't realize Elvis has left the house. If you don't have the Eucharist, the king's not there.
Yeah.
You're playing a record.
That's right.
And the king, right. you're playing a documentary about the king, the interpretation of the king. But with us, Elvis is in the house singing the whole time.
Yeah. And I didn't understand that. I thought, why do they have all these fancy buildings? Why is all this stuff? I just didn't understand. That's Jesus's crib, bro. I didn't get it. And then, I mean, that's radically changed everything. I don't go, I like the priests at the cathedral I go to, but I'm not particularly interested in the homily. I'm glad it's short. I'm thankful for what they say. I'm there to see Jesus. And that's the reason I'm there. And that's the reason that building looks like it looks, and the glory and the splendor of it. It's not for me. It's not attractional for me. And I remember getting so upset in my nerdy way as a Protestant minister saying, well, Kierkegaard said that the church service isn't for us. It's supposed to be this way, you know. But we removed what would make it worth someone coming. And that was... that's a tough pill as a Protestant minister for me to swallow. Yeah, I can't make people come here because I'm not, the cult of personality is not the way to go.
I thought I was the main attraction. It's all about me. It's all about my 30-minute opinion up here and how revelationary it can be, how, you know, the latest thing, the latest revelation.
Absolutely.
And advertising that.
Absolutely.
You know, I gave me something really good. You don't want to miss it.
Absolutely.
Go and ahead, then, the tapes.
Yeah. And then down. Yeah, exactly. Pay $3 for my tape to listen to it.
Yeah.
And I was, but down the street, Jesus was in that building. I didn't know it. And we went to, Amber and I went to New York real quick the other week. And we stopped at St. Patrick's and did a little tour because she'd gone to Mass there, but I hadn't. And I went around, saw everything, did the tour. And then I was like, let's go back in the back in the chapel where Jesus is at. And got down there, got on my knees, and spent a couple of minutes in adoration before we had to go on to our next thing. And said, man, Jesus is in this building right now. You know, I don't have to go around trying to find him. I don't have to try to whoop him up. I don't have to, you know, hear the 30-second bridge of a praise and worship song to finally feel like I got Jesus.
Yeah. Man, that's really good. I could talk to you all night long. Have you been to the Holy Week on Thursday night yet?
No, not officially.
Take Jesus away.
Do what?
Where they actually preach takes Jesus away from the and puts the burial cloth and has the umbrella and they start singing that real sad song and you're not allowed to speak till you get in your court.
No, I'm looking forward to it though.
Best one of the year. Better than Easter Sunday, Good Friday. I love that. That Thursday night, I forget what they call it exactly, but it's when they institute the Lord's Supper, institute the washing of the feet. Then all of a sudden they come in and arrest Jesus and carry him away. It's very emotional. Mm-hmm. And they carry him to the chapel or wherever you're at. They move him from the big house, take him to the chapel. They got him all covered up, the umbrella, and they're sad. And you're not supposed to talk. You go in there and everybody falls to their knees and they're playing that song. Pangi Ligura, I don't even know how to say it. I'll text it to you. But you get in and they put Jesus and they blow out the red candle because he's gone now. And they suck all the water out of the baptismal font, out of the whole house. And you come in there Friday. And by habit, you go in there on Friday morning. Everybody does it. You get dry. I mean, that thing is bone dry. And it just hits you.
Yeah.
Everything's shrouded and you got no water and it's just no mass.
Yeah.
Only day of the year where there's no mass. That's very sad.
Yeah. That's the beauty of worshiping with your whole body and with your senses. You really feel it, you know.
I'm excited for you, man. I'm excited. Thanks. Thursday night, don't forget.
I'm excited now. I'm looking forward to it and I can't forgive me if I said something wrong or took a different path on it because I'm still new, you know.
I'm new too. I love you, man. I'm gonna have to.
I love you too.
I gotta get out, go to work here for a little bit, but let's stay in touch. I'll send you that song. And wait, is this guy a convert? Super Scandinavian. He's a 24 hour old convert.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm converting any day now. Well, I'm happy for everybody. And I'll have this uploaded on Spotify tomorrow night, probably.
Great.
And if you talk to Jamie or your mom and dad.
I'll let them. Okay. Sure will. Man, it's good to see you. Good to talk to you.
I'll call you soon, okay?
Okay. Thanks, bud.
Brother.
Bye. Bye.